This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands and Chile, directed to New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perrell.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome again to another edition of the program. Now, we actually have a few things to get to. Our first story today has to do with the arrest and detention of an ABC crew. That's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Last week, a crew from the ABC was in Malaysia working on a documentary for a program for ABC television. Now, when they were there, they caused a little bit of a problem. They were detained because they were trying to ask a question to the Prime Minister about a corruption scandal that has captivated the whole country. They were escorted out of Malaysia after a threatening case against them was dropped. Reporter Linton Basir and cameraman Louis Iglu landed in Singapore not long after. Now, I should mention, by the way, that a few years ago, if you asked which country was the worst concerning media freedom in Southeast Asia, the first country that would have come to mind is Burma, known also as Myanmar. But that has changed dramatically since the political reforms in Burma. Well, there's a lot more free media than there once was. Malaysia, however, is going in the opposite direction. Mark Kovine spoke to Linton Basir as he was waiting at the Singapore Airport Lounge.
I mean, he was walking past a large crowd. You know, flash bulbs were going off. There were cameras on him. It was a public media event.
Now, you've been accused of crossing some lines, of breaking some rules. Were you aware of crossing any lines, any cordons? Were there any rules that had been outlined to you that you broke?
Absolutely none. And that is why initially it was so disturbing when we were told we were going to be charged with a criminal offence, because, Mark, as you'd expect, we have vision of this incident, and it's incontrovertible. And there is absolutely no police cordon. We have audio. There are no instructions given.
And what did you ask him, Linton?
I asked him how he could explain, or whether he could explain, the hundreds of millions of dollars that have flowed into his personal bank accounts in recent years.
How did he react?
He initially looked at me when I introduced myself, and then he continued walking and ignored me.
So it was a mute response?
You could put it that way, and, from him anyway.
And what about his entourage?
Well, I was immediately surrounded by police and Malaysian intelligence special branch, operatives, basically detained on the spot, taken out of the area in which I was standing. Louis Aroglu, our cinematographer, was then also detained and brought to where I was, because we had been separated in the kind of crush in the crowd. And it kind of went on from there. The police were very upset with us because, of course, they had been embarrassed that a foreign journalist had been able to ask the Prime Minister a question. Anyway, we had our passports examined, our details taken. They took photos of every form of ID we had in our wallet, I think. And then the superintendent said to us, look, if you go quietly, it's okay, get in your car and go. So we did. And we got in our van. We didn't actually have a hotel booking, so we having had a little fright, we thought it might be prudent to get on the first flight out of Sarawak. We tried that. There were no seats available on the last flight out, I'm sorry. So we tried to find a hotel, but as we were pulling up to the first hotel we were going to try, we were pulled over by an unmarked car and four or five police pulled us down from the van and questioned us in the lobby of the hotel and then told us that we were going to be placed under arrest.
How long were you detained?
Look, I can't quite remember, but it's been reported as 6 hours. That sounds about right to me.
And then you had this period when you weren't sure whether you'd be able to get out of the country and you might be charged.
Well, yeah, we had our passports confiscated, that's right. And so I think we got to bed that night at 4 or 5 in the morning and we didn't have any passports. I think this was the, this must have been Sunday. I'm sorry, I haven't slept for a day, so excuse me. But and then the next event was very strange because then we get some good news from our lawyer who tells us that the local police want to meet us to return our passports. So we thought, great, we packed up, we got ready to leave Sarawak on the next available flight. And strangely, it was quite comical. The police in their Hawaiian shirts decided that the safest place to do this was the pool deck of our hotel. So we all sat around garden furniture as they formally handed back our passports. But then they said to us, you can't leave, you're still on police bail. Which was confusing. We didn't understand for what purpose they'd returned our passports.
And eventually you got out. Have you got the material that you need to make this Four Corners program?
We haven't lost any material, Mark. So we're here in Singapore planning our next moves, but we intend to continue investigating the story.
And you obviously won't be able to go back into Malaysia. Are you coming back to Australia now?
We're still planning it, but I think I won't be back for a few more days yet, actually. Although, just on your first point, it's not clear to me that I won't be allowed back into Malaysia. It's been widely reported that we've been deported by Malaysian authorities, and indeed, we were whisked through Kuching Airport and immigration and customs clearance by uniformed police, and even all the way to our seats on the plane where we were photographed by a very nice policeman, ASP Sofian. But at no point were we told we were being deported. Our passports don't say we've been deported. We were never given a piece of paper to say that that was the case. I understand anyway that Malaysian authorities or local government authorities in Sarawak are now saying that that is the case, but we're none the wiser.
So the ABC crew were detained by authorities for asking the Prime Minister of Malaysia a very simple question, just for him to account for himself against the corruption charges. Now, I should mention that a Malaysian court found the Prime Minister innocent of any wrongdoing. But every other nation around the world is asking Malaysia to explain itself because there is so much material against the Prime Minister. Now, Malaysia is sliding into a dark period of media and civil society restrictions. We've seen this happen over the last couple of years. We have this story from Peter Lloyd.
Not so long ago, Burma was the region's pariah state. Now, it's a toddler democracy showing up near neighbours like Malaysia. And if you want to gauge the depth of political weirdness in our near neighbour, just listen as this particular retiree vents his spleen.
You can't even criticise the government. Where is the democracy?
The voice may not be as strident, but even at the grand old age of 90, there's no mistaking the proverbial strongman, Mahathir Mohamad, holding court before the media. In power for 22 years, Mahathir was the boss. A draconian Internal Security Act kept Malaysians in their place. Now, though, he wears new political colours in a spectacular U-turn. Old man Mahathir is a champion of all things free and liberal.
Today, this country's reputation is rotten. You see, it's shameful, all because of one man's leadership.
That man is current Prime Minister Najib Razak. To Dr. M, Najib's a tyrant in waiting, a kleptocrat who just can't explain away $1 billion from the Saudi royal family, passing through a personal bank account. It's some kind of irony that Mahathir's law and order legacy means he could go to jail for speaking out.
I know during my time we have the ISA, but I don't use the ISA to arrest people who criticize me, only when they do something wrong to the country. But here, if you criticize, you are going to be called in for questioning and even detained and tried.
The arrest of a foreign media crew has been cited by rights lawyers as the most egregious attack on freedom of speech since Najib began consolidating power. But it's just the latest crackdown in what's been a power play between the political elite of UMNO, who've ruled Malaysia since independence, and a determined civil society. The prominent senior lawyer and human rights campaigner, Ambiga Srinivasan, is one of the leading lights of that movement.
The questioning is something that the Prime Minister is very sensitive about. But I think most right-thinking Malaysians would be appalled by what the government has done. Malaysians have been suffering. We've had a terrible infringement of our human rights. There's been a shutting down of democratic spaces.
How does it compare to the way the Malaysian media is treated when they deal with the Prime Minister?
Pretty much the same. I suppose because the issue of passport confiscation wouldn't arise with Malaysians. But certainly we have felt, as I said before, closing of the democratic spaces, and there are many threats to citizens and journalists who wish to report fairly and freely.
How free are the media in Malaysia to speak about this issue and to investigate it further?
Well, not very free. The online media has some leeway, appears to have some leeway, but even that now is being, you know, restricted.
The Najib Prime Ministership began with lofty promises to give Malaysians even more freedom and space. Instead, though, he's done the opposite. He updated the Colonial Era Sedition Act to criminalise certain acts of journalism. Harsh criminal defamation laws were tweaked. And for the first time in Malaysia, a Prime Minister can sue media organisations for defamation. That is a direct lift from the intimidation tactics invented by Lee Kuan Yew. Najib is not acting in isolation. He's got a parliament of enabling MPs whose political lives depend on money politics. Lawyer Ambiga Srinivasan.
It's as if you're living in two different countries. You know, sometimes when you read the online media, you see certain news reports carried. You will never hear any of it in the mainstream media. But this prime minister came in with a reformist attitude and he said, look, I'm going to free everything up. He actually, managed to repeal certain legislation that appeared to be restrictive. But then, of course, the scandal hit and then things started getting more and more restrictive.
Malaysia's media shrank even more as the ABC team's arrest was playing out. The owner of one popular news site, Malaysia Insider, shut operations this week. The government had blocked them from the net after critical coverage. And the weirdness abounds tonight. The deputy that Mahathir had jailed, Anwar Ibrahim, is one of the marquee names in the strange friend and foe alliance trying to push Najib from office peacefully. Tonight, the 90-year-old Mahathir's Twitter account features the reformed strongman being mobbed like a rock star by teenagers. All this as Prime Minister Najib toughs it out on the back of a strategy of making poodles of the press all over again.
We now turn our attention to social media. We have seen time and time again women posting pictures on Facebook, for example, of them breastfeeding their baby, and then Facebook taking the pictures down. Well, this recently happened to Aboriginal women in Australia who put a picture on Facebook and had their account suspended, even though they were nude, but they were wearing traditional Aboriginal dress. Penny Timms reports.
When proud feminist and freelance writer Celeste Liddle spoke to a packed audience for International Women's Day, her speech struck a chord.
The main focus for the entire thing was the intersection between feminism and Indigenous rights.
A version of that speech has since been picked up by online publication New Matilda. But when it published the speech, the outlet included a photograph of two Aboriginal women taking part in a traditional ceremony. That's because Celeste Little's speech had mentioned a previous incident in which Facebook had suspended her for sharing an image of Aboriginal women dancing. All had bare chests.
New Matilda wanted to publish it because it was Indigenous feminism, and why they chose that image to accompany the photo was within the speech itself. I spoke about last year how my page had been set upon by trolls and then threatened by Facebook because I posted up the preview video for the Triple M comedy series and Facebook removing the content because it had images of desert women painted up in traditional paint doing traditional dancing. The image was to accompany that main point that I made within the overall context of the speech.
But after New Matilda published the piece, Facebook suspended Celeste Little's account. It's also suspended the accounts of users who've shared the article.
They suspended it for reasons of nudity. That's the reason that they've given nudity and sexually explicit nature. So they've deemed this picture of Aboriginal women painted up culturally to be nudity and sexually explicit, which it obviously isn't. It's women practicing several millennia's worth of culture.
Ms. Little has attempted to get in contact with Facebook about the issue, with no luck. She says the company lacks understanding about Aboriginal culture. Luke Pearson is the founding director of the social media project Indigenous X.
Unfortunately, not much in this space shocks me anymore, but clearly disappointed, I think, would be the best response here. It's a perfectly appropriate photo in context of an article that's been written.
Ms. Little has launched a petition aimed at getting Facebook to review its policies and to make them more culturally inclusive.
Within, say, 11 hours, it had already hit 10,000 supporters, and it's been quite widely shared. Funnily enough, that petition's also been banned off of Facebook or been taken down from some posts because I did include the picture that New Matilda had used within their original news report to show what it was that Facebook is actually banning.
Mr. Pearson is hopeful that public support will force Facebook to have a change of heart.
I think in situations like this, it really wouldn't be difficult for Facebook, for any other social media company in a similar situation, to apply some practical wisdom, common sense and basic respect. And so, yeah, I am optimistic that there could be some movement here. And clearly all it would take is anyone with half a mind to have a look at it and go, yeah, we can understand the context of this photo, it's perfectly appropriate, and that should be the end of it.
But Facebook has defended its action. In a written statement, a company spokesperson says, "We are aware that people sometimes share content containing nudity for reasons like awareness campaigns, artistic projects, or cultural investigations. The reasons we restrict the display of nudity is because some audiences within our global community may be sensitive to this type of content, particularly because of cultural background or age. In order to treat people fairly and respond to reports quickly, it is essential that we have policies in place that our global teams can apply uniformly and easily when reviewing content. As a result, our policies can sometimes be more blunt than we would like." The statement concludes by suggesting that users share Ms. Little's speech without the accompanying photograph.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. In a moment, we're going to talk about something that some of you listening right now have brought up before on our Facebook page. It has to do with secondhand radios.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Charlie 105, it is PDF 222 journal.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, let's talk about something that anybody who's a radio fan or DXer or a shortwave listener has done at some point or another. Many of you haven't, but there are many that have. Even I have done this. And that is, you're looking for another shortwave radio. Nothing so unusual about that. Most of us would just go and buy a new one out of the box. But every so often, there's maybe a particular model or a particular design that you actually like, but the radio is no longer being made. So what option do you have? Well, the option is surfing the internet, going to websites like eBay, and seeing if somebody has a secondhand one for sale. Now, this is a bit of a touchy issue with some people. If you do a search on an auction site like eBay for old radios, we'll choose one off, let's say, like off the top of my head, like the ICF-2010 from Sony, which in its day was a very popular and expensive shortwave radio. Now, this radio hasn't been produced for a number of years. If you go on eBay, you will find these radios selling anywhere between $150 and $200. Now, if the radio is in good nick, good condition, meaning it plays well, there's nothing wrong with the volume knob or tuning knob, and the outward condition maybe has a few little scraps and scuffs, just having to do with how old it is, but pretty overall it's pretty good. Actually, it's not a bad price. But every so often, on eBay, you'll find a radio like the Sony ICF-2010 selling for over $1,000. Not just the Sony ICF-2010, but also other models from Sony and other shortwave radios themselves. Now, I have a particular problem with this. First of all, sure, anybody, if they want to sell the radio for however much they want, that is really their own business. I couldn't care less about that. But they have to be somewhat realistic. Anybody in the electronics industry will tell you that electronic items such as radios, televisions, DVD players, even computers, over time lose their value. In fact, from the moment you purchase it, the value actually goes down. So when you have a radio that's maybe 25 years old and they're selling it for over $1,000, even though the condition is good, it isn't actually the true value of the radio. Now, there are some radios, however, that do bring in big money, and it really depends on a few factors. First, who made it? And, more importantly, who designed it? Now, you've heard me talk about radio design on the program before, and this is something that I enjoy very much. I love a good, clean design of a radio. So, if you see a Braun radio or turntable, or any other electronic item from the 60s or 70s that was designed by Dieter Rams, who designed many items for Braun, those will bring in big money. For example, a Braun T1000 shortwave receiver, which Braun has not made in, well, years, it was only produced for a very short period of time, this can actually bring in to up to $2,000. And that is one that is in okay condition. One that is in perfect min condition can bring into over $5,000. Again, the radio is designed beautifully and is a good piece of kit, and it wasn't produced for a very long period of time, so it was not an overproduced product. An ICF-2010, however, from Sony, was a mass-produced product. So the value, actually, for a mass-produced product is a lot less than an item that wasn't mass-produced. Also, when you have a reputable designer like Dieter Rams involved, of course the cost will go up. Now, sometimes you'll find old receivers and they'll say things like, refurbished, completely refurbished, everything changed and cleaned. Now, yes, you can actually buy the radio or even sell the radio for more money if that work has been done. But it all has to be kept in confines of how much the actual item is. Now, some people would say, the sellers are crazy for selling it at this price. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't say that at all. I would say those willing to pay the outrageous prices for some of the used electronic items on eBay are the crazy ones. Now, if you are looking for a used shortwave radio, there are some really good deals out there on eBay. But there are a few things you should beware of. Never buy a radio where in the description it says, "The last time I tried it, the radio worked." Chances are the radio doesn't work. If there's a pretty good deal on a radio where somebody posts, "I don't have any way to test it or check it," don't buy it. These are the two things you really have to watch out for. Now, if somebody has a radio, but they have no way of checking it, how about just putting some batteries inside it? There's a battery compartment and finding out. And if somebody says or writes, "Oh, the last time I tried it, it worked." Well, you don't know how long that is. That could be last week. It could be last month. It could be 10 years ago. Now, we've seen with some electronic items over time, if they are not used, the knobs and whatever else actually will become faulty. So it is buyer beware. So keep this in mind the next time you're looking for a secondhand product on eBay or any other auction sites. And we'd like to find out actually if you had any experiences buying used items, negative or positive, and we will share them on the program. Well, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect over the next 7 days. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through March 19th. Normal at all latitudes except normal to fair at high latitudes on the 18th. From Space Weather South Africa through March 19th, magnetic conditions quiet to unsettled, shortwave fade-outs unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK, the summary of geomagnetic activity waning to mainly quiet on March 19th and 20th. From FK Yanda of the Czech Propagation Interest Group, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to active on March 17th, 28th, and April 5th. Mostly quiet on March 18th, 19th, 22nd, 24th, 31st, and April 6th. Quiet on March 20th, 21st, 23rd, 25th to 27th, April 1st and 2nd. Quiet to unsettled on March 29th and 30th. Active to disturbed on April 3rd and 4th. From SWPC in Boulder, ANK indices only 5 and 2, March 19th to 31st. Geomagnetic field activity expected to reach G1 minor storm levels April 2nd and 3rd, peaking at 20 and 5. Active conditions expected April 8th at 12 and 4. Solar flux peaking at 100 March 29th to 31st, otherwise 95 or 90. Via ARRL, spaceweather.com says, the weeks around vernal equinox March 20th are a time for increased auroral activity. 6-meter operators will want to be alert, and also FMDXers. Bill Hepburn's VHF, UHF, DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting off Baja California, March 21st and 22nd. All week off the southern Arabian coast to India and the Bay of Bengal from India to Myanmar.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well, saying 73 and 88 to the ladies.